dancing so much. And I decided then when the dancers were on Saturday night, you needed, you know, another dress. You couldn't wear the same dress. And so I said to Mum, I'll make one. Mum tried to teach me, but I'm left-handed and she couldn't cope with me threading the needle the wrong way. So I decided to make myself an easy tennis dress to start. And then after that, I thought, oh, this is going well. I'll make myself a proper dress. So it was a little bit hard to start buying patterns and the materials. And I started on a treadle sewing machine, and it was not easy.
You're listening to All the Best. My name's Michaela Morgan, and that's my great-auntie Nolene.
And then a year or so later, Mum decided to buy an automatic Singer sewing machine. And it was just wonderful because it went forwards and backwards and could do so much more. And it made life, you know, that much easier for me. And the patterns were so good, Vogue and McCall. And so to make those dresses was really, you know, a pleasure. And the materials were so beautiful, they spoke for themselves. And so, you know, and it was just so beautiful because you felt you accomplished something every time you made a dress, something that you did for yourself and you didn't have to go to the shop to buy.
She'd spend a few hours every night after work to get her next ball gown ready, just in the nick of time.
I remember I made this, my first strapless dress, which I had to bone so that it didn't fall down. And it was quite a lot of work in it to get this thing. And the ball was coming up on the Saturday night, and by Thursday, I still had a lot to do. So I had to ring up in the morning and I said, I'm terribly sorry, I'm just too sick, I can't come in, I'm taking a sick day.
So while Nolene finished off her strapless gown, her boyfriend Alan phoned up her work to say hello, only to be told she was ill and recovering at home.
There was a knock at the front door and I thought, oh my goodness, no, what's this? He'd come from work in the city, hopped on the train and brought a box of strawberries. You're sick today. And I felt that guilty because, no, I'm really not sick. I'm finishing this dress up for the weekend.
So you've chucked a sickie to make your new dress and it's finally done. It's Sydney, 1952. Where do you hit the town?
We went to a lot of other balls. There were sometimes at the rowing club, sometimes, well, Marrickville Town Hall. Any of the old boys' balls, which were the college balls. There was an old boys' ball. There was a green and gold ball, which was the one where we all made our debuts. And they were at the Sydney Town Hall. We made our debuts at the Sydney Town Hall. And the night I made my debut, I asked this fellow, Jock Marnie, to be my partner. And they said, why'd you do that? Because I said, he was the best quick stepper I knew, and he could do double time. But it was raining, and he had to pick me up at the footpath at the Sydney Town Hall, carry me right up the steps to get into the front door because it was raining.
But as far as balls were concerned, there was just one that was considered the jewel in the crown of Sydney nightlife, just a couple of blocks down on George Street from the town hall.
Well, a lot of them were at the Trocadero, which was the most wonderful orchestra. What was his name? Coughlin. Oh, it was about a 15-piece orchestra at least. And it had a sprung floor. And as soon as that music started at the Trocadero, it was wonderful.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For the next hour, you'll be entertained by the Trocadero, Australia's greatest entertainment unit.
So you had your quick steps, your foxtrots, your jazz waltz, and those. And then in the middle of that, they do the Pride of Erin, the Canadian three-step, and of course there's always a barn dance at the end where everybody mixes with everybody, so you get a turn with every boy or every partner. And the boys used to come over and say, can I book that dance for the so-and-so, or can I book that dance? So you would book a dance with a partner so that you knew who you were going to dance with, sort of thing. We've got string beans and onions,
cabbages and scallions and all kinds. The balls at the Trocadero would end just after midnight on a Saturday, And one night, because Nolene was rushing to get another dress made in time, she managed to leave out one important detail.
I was always trying to finish something off at the last minute. And it was an evening dress, a big long evening dress. And I said to Mum, Alan will be here to take me in the Jeep. But I remember this night and I said to her, I haven't had time to put the zipper in. Can you sew me up? So I said, oh, for heaven's sake. So she had to sew up the thing. We didn't get home till 1:30 in the morning because we'd sailed after the ball. And I had to knock on Mum's bedroom door. Mum, you got to come and unpick me because I can't get my dress off.
The boy who drove her home that night has been married to Nolene for nearly 60 years. And even though, during the years before they got married, Alan would be studying hard at night to become a solicitor, Nolene would still attend all the balls. But no matter who she danced with that night, Alan would be waiting out the front to pick Nolene up in his dad's Morris Minor. You're listening to All the Best. My name's Michaela Morgan. That's my great-auntie Nolene. Normally when you chat to your grandparents on the phone, they tell you about what your cousins are up to, what's on the telly, how fast the grass is growing, but not the stories of their own lives. This week we asked our grandparents, or in my case, my great-aunt, to tell us a story they've never told us before. Thing is, sometimes the things our grandparents say are racist or homophobic, and occasionally we allow them these prejudices because of their age. Pip Rasmussen spoke to her grandmother about a time in Australia when there was a great fear of HIV, but she saw past the common misconceptions and held out her hand to her friends who were suffering.
Well, my name's Patricia. My family call me Patricia Mary. 30 years ago, I worked for a very large company in the city. And I began to notice that some of the, probably the nicer boys, were having odd days off. And I was thinking, gosh, are they leaning on us or what's the matter with them? Anyway, eventually, one of them popped into the GM and he came out and he looked at me and he said, you know, don't you? And the penny dropped. I thought he's got HIV. I really didn't know if he was gay or not, but I had a feeling he might have been because he was really sweet-natured and very intelligent, very well-dressed. So he came out. So I said to him, do you want to come out and have a coffee? And he said, we'll go for a walk in the gardens.
And if you're still breathing, you're the lucky ones.
So out we went. We had a little walk in the gardens and he told me his story, how he'd come from Tasmania. He'd worked for United Nations at one stage and he'd come back to Australia and joined our company. When he found out about this, his family disowned him, which just hurt him so much. That we both had a good cry together in the gardens because he was just so hurt and didn't really know where to go. But he had a partner and his partner was a doctor and he'd been in a relationship for quite some time. And eventually he was having more and more days away from work and he was getting thinner and thinner. So he eventually gave up work and once a week he'd come into town and we'd have a sandwich in the botanical gardens and within 3 months he was like a skeleton and one day he came in and he had a big straw hat on and a long sleeve shirt and the cuffs were covering his hands. It was immaculately pressed, I must say. And I thought, what on earth is he doing? And then I found out that with the treatment he was having, he couldn't be exposed to sun. So that was the very last time that Tony and I had lunch together in the gardens. And every time I hear the word Tony now, I think of this boy. I do really, you know. And everybody would give them a wide berth as though they weren't human. You know, this is why they didn't dare talk about it. My husband was so cockeyed about people with AIDS. He really thought that they were all precocious and deserved what they got, but they weren't. The ones that I knew were hard workers, really, really intelligent boys. They all seemed to be quite involved in the arts and music. And but this young boy, it was so tragic when he went, it just seemed so terrible. When you went to their funerals, they all had funerals at one of the little old inner city churches, and they were so amazing because the people who had AIDS would arrange the funerals, and so many times the parents would be eventually, because their child had died, they'd think, oh well, you know, we'll arrange the funeral. And of course the people that had been looking after them said, no way, you know, they're ours, they're not yours any longer, you didn't want them when they needed you. So there were a lot of discussions and difficulties over some of these funerals, but they were beautifully done, there's no doubt about it. They had a great depth to their soul, and they really were soulful. You know, it was very, very, very sad time for them, because life was just so hard, because they didn't come out like they do today. There was none of that. You know, it was all hidden. And so they were carrying this disease. And I can remember when Neil went to the dentist, had a terrible toothache, and the dentist said, oh no, I'm not treating you. And the dentist wouldn't treat him because of the blood. He thought, you know, if he had a cut, he could contract it. Then, you know, every aspect of their life was difficult, and people thought they were all promiscuous and miserable, but they were not. I didn't meet one. They were like my children. They ended up being like my children. That's how I felt about them, and I could still cry over them because they had such a hard, sad life.
That story from Pip Rasmussen about her grandmother, Patricia Mary. Today on All the Best, we're asking our grandparents to tell us a story that they've never told us before. And of course, the best stories are love stories. Holiday romances have a tendency to fizzle out, but in the case of Sydney Peed's grandparents, it went strong for over 50 years. Sydney spoke to her grandma and found out how it all began.
Granddad and Mum went down to the Esplanade guest house, which was on that road that runs along the beach. Anyway, we'd been there for a couple of days, and this group of surf club blokes from Sydney arrived. I came down to breakfast, that's right, and there were seven of them at the table and just one chair. And the girls put me there on the table with the seven fellas. And that was fine, but I think it was the meal at night that they put me at that table. And anyway, when I came in the morning, because they all stood up, and I was so embarrassed, you know, the whole breakfast people were there and all these fellas stood up for me. Anyway, I mean, Helen and I got on right away. We just clicked, you know, and we used to go have drinks at the pub and, you know, talk politics and get to know one another. So then I just spent my time with those seven fellas for the rest of my holiday. It was great fun. I remember we came home one night and I went into my room and got into bed. And the boys arrived back and Doug sings out, "Where's Vaughn? Where's Vaughn?" And Mum was horrified. She said, "Those boys were singing out for you in the middle of the night." What would people think, you know? Oh, dear. But that was just it. I was just part of the group. And wherever they went, I went. one of the books.
Hal and Yvonne were married a year later on October 3rd, 1952, until Hal's death in 1997. Yvonne now lives in Burleigh Waters, Queensland, where they fell in love all those years ago. That story was produced by their granddaughter, Sydney Peed. This week's episode of All the Best, Did I Ever Tell You, is all about the stories we don't usually get to hear from our grandparents. There have always been unanswered questions about Flynn's refugee grandfather. Flynn's mum describes him as a polymath admired by people from all walks of life and disciplines who would join him in his study for intense discussions that would last hours. He arrived in Australia in February 1951 on board the SS Castelbianco. The family mythology holds that he was born in Russia and raised in a military academy after returning home one day to find his mother frozen to death. That's all he ever said about his parents, apart from the fact they were Russian. A few weeks ago, Flynn found a suitcase full of documents that might answer some of those questions.
Well, it's an old brown, dusty suitcase. It's a Globite suitcase, I believe. It's got a Globite.
Yeah, open it up.
I didn't know a lot about Bill. I mean, his name is Sevalod. It's a Russian name, but when he came to Australia, nobody could pronounce that. So he called himself Bill. I mean, he wasn't ever in my life. He passed away in 1982, before I was born. I had a sort of a connection with him through my grandmother and through my mum. But it was always through sort of the odd anecdote and the odd story. You know, there was never like a complete sort of narrative of his life. And often those stories would be remembered and misremembered. And, you know, he himself was a storyteller and a poet, and so there was always a grain of salt with everything. There was always an idea that a lot of these stories and a lot of his own stories about his past and his history and where he'd come from may have been, you know, fabricated or may have been exaggerated. So there's a series of letters which are written in Russian. Everything's sort of quite old, and it looks kind of like when in primary school you'd make a treasure map and cover it all in tea. It's all got that sort of old, aged sort of look about it. There's a lot of frayed edges.
Okay, let's go through it.
Yep. This large document here is his certificate of naturalisation as an Australian citizen. There are more letters in a manila folder. If I got to remain in Australia, that would have obviously come.
I've actually got the document here, which is the
November of 1957. I think the boarding pass from the ship that they came on. Obviously, that's Bill Sevalov, the man himself. Slicked back hair. I mean, what's interesting is, you know, in the suitcase, I found his original birth certificate. That document actually says he was born in Yugoslavia as a stateless ex-Russian. But the story that we've always been told, that I've always been told, and that that my mother believed, was that side of the family was in fact Russian. My mother always believed that he was born in Russia. And so to discover that he was in fact born in Serbia is really casts doubt on a lot of the things that I thought I knew about my grandfather. This is actually a story that my mother recounted to me, and now she would have been about three or four at the time when she came over. They came over on a boat. I mean, they were boat people by the current definition. When my grandfather and grandmother and mother landed, the story goes that they only had enough money to purchase a banana, a single banana, and they cut that into three pieces and they shared that. That was the scale of their poverty at the time. Now again, that's interesting because another narrative that I've heard is that my grandmother was actually from some sort of royal stock, which is interesting because our background has always been our family myth, I guess, has always been of a working class sort of migrant family. But there's a lot of holes in that story that I'd like to fill in. There was at one stage, a belief in my family that I was watched by some sort of intelligence service when they first came out in the 50s, which, you know, is not unbelievable. I mean, they were Russian. I was told that there were sort of men sweating in suits, you know, parked in cars out the front of the house. And, you know, he was a Russian intellectual. That was always his identity. He was an extraordinary man with a lot of different skills in a lot of different areas. He was a scientist and an architect and a physicist and a poet and a writer. It makes sense that perhaps my mother and my grandmother were a little bit dubious about some of the things that he said and some of the stories he told, because, I mean, he was a storyteller, you know. There is a story within the suitcase that is his.
That story was produced by Heidi Pett. This week we've heard stories from our grandparents that we'd never heard before, and I went and visited my great aunt in Canberra, which was the perfect excuse to go and have a lunch with her and her husband. We want you to do the same. Go and talk to your grandparents and find out what stories they have to tell you, and get in touch with us at allthebestradio.com. Producer Lucy Robson sat with her grandpa by the fire, and he told her the story of crazy Aunt Jess.
I told you about the two Aunt Jesses I had back in Australia. My father's sister, she was Aunt Jess, and then this other Aunt Jess was my grandmother's sister, and she, my great-grandfather, being a millionaire, and my grandmother was quite wealthy, and it's all sorts of stories about everyone.
Yeah, I know.
This Aunt Jess, who was my grandmother's sister, and one of the Scottish relatives came out to stay in Toowoomba for about 3 months. And Aunt Jess fell in love with him. And she thought her love was reciprocated, but it wasn't.
Aww.
And so the cousin went back to Glasgow, and he married this talented German girl. And when Aunt Jess found it, she said her heart was broken and no one would ever see her face again. And she used to go around with a thick motoring veil. You couldn't see her face.
Really?
Yeah. And she said no one would ever see her face again because her heart was broken. And so my great-grandfather, who was still a millionaire at that time, he said, told my grandmother, you'll have to look after the sister. She's too silly. And the grandmother said, well, I ain't too willing, but I couldn't fit her into my house. I'd need some additions to the house. And she said, of course, Aunt Jess's estate will naturally pay for that. And so she doubled the size of the house.
Look after the silly aunt.
Yeah. But then after about 3 years, the silly aunt got better, and so her father gave her own house, and then she concentrated on doing good to people. She used to visit people, and then when she left, she laid a check on the mantelpiece, all these poor people. She had these three beautiful nieces, and both of them got married, and then the younger, Sheila. She was a very nice looking girl, but she never seemed to get engaged, and Aunt Jess said, you have to do something for her. And so she took her for a cruise around South America and hoped that she'd meet someone. And she didn't meet anyone. And then so she came back, and Aunt Jess, well, I have to try again. So she went a cruise all around Japan and China and another ocean cruise. And in the end, she got engaged to the cruise captain.
That's a good story. And she got a free holiday out of all of it.
That story from Lucy Robson. This episode of All the Best was produced at Sin Radio in Melbourne in association with FBI Radio in Sydney and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode, Pip Rasmussen, Sydney Peed, and Lucy Robson.
Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. Our community coordinator is Pip Rasmussen. And our executive producers are Jordana Caputo and Belinda Lopez.
You're listening to All the Best. My name's Michaela Morgan. That's my great-auntie Nolene.
All the Best is played across Australia on Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Home, Jack, where you are in the winter. I don't mean to worry you, I just missed you. Where you are on the mountaintop or down below, where the valley drops. Oh, Jack, where you are in the winter. Oh, Jack, put a ring on a finger. Surrender to the skies and you might be her. Stop the lies and butterflies and put your hands on both her thighs. Oh, Jack, marry her up and be together. Brush their hair and fix their teeth. Oh, Jack, nice to know you. It was a pleasure.